And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte, skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic, and I am joined once again by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. Doug, are you in a car?
I'm in a vehicle, yes. It is a sport utility vehicle, but I am not driving, so do not be alarmed.
Okay. Yes. I'm grateful to hear that. For those listening, our guest this week will be Jed Hoyer, the president of baseball operations with those surging Chicago Cubs. But before we get to Jed, we need to talk about Doug, because Doug, as you can see, if you're watching this on YouTube, is on an official road trip. He and the Glanvilles driving home from Williamsport, yes, PA, as we speak. So let's start with a travel update. Do you know where the heck you are right now?
We left Pennsylvania. I think we are in New York State. We are on our way to Connecticut. So we're in good shape. We left Williamsport this morning, and it's not too far. It's like 5 hours this, It was a very nice 3-day weekend. So it's been wonderful reconnecting with roots of high school. Teachers. It was a nice run.
So we know that all roads definitely do not lead to Williamsport, but fortunately, some roads actually do. So the Phillies and Nationals got there Sunday, and also you did, to call that game on ESPN Radio with Roxy Bernstein. And Doug, what was the coolest thing that you think you did in Williamsport? Did you get a chance to slide down that hill?
I did not do the hill. Laundry's a little challenging on the road, and it's a mud fest at times. So I know there's a dry side, and that's what the Nationals did. But no, I didn't do the hill. I'm also turning 53 this week. I don't need anything dislocated or anything like that. So I did Bernie Brewer's already. I did the slide in Milwaukee. That there's nothing you can top that.
Yeah.
So I'm good. It was wonderful. And my wife is from Pennsylvania and Delaware area, so we got to reconnect with some old friends, old teachers, and that was really nice. I don't know if you know the big-time Williamsport reporter, Chris Massey. He's a high school friend of my wife's. And he writes like 5 stories a day, too, in Little League. So he's really busy. So that was, it was really cool. So but we had a really good time. But, I connected – this was kind of a little random, but Dave Martinez, the manager of the Nationals, and Darnell Coles, one of the hitting coaches, they were the guys I worked out with in Tampa when I was trying to get up to the big leagues or just got there. So they're both, as you know, staff of the Nationals. So I took a picture with them, and I hadn't seen both of them together since, I'm not even sure. We have to go into mid-90s. It had to be almost 30 years, 25. Yeah, it was crazy. So, it was just wonderful to see the little leaguers. I loved watching major league players go back to childhood and little leaguers be in childhood, at the same time. They just fed off each other, and the enthusiasm and just the way that they were, major league players were so accessible. you know, they're right there on the field. They're sitting in the stands. It was just a great connection. And I, you know, I had a lot of memories in positive ways of some of the minor leagues where you just had access to fans and just to call the game, you know, just, it felt real personal, you know, and Williamsport changes overnight into this, you know, little league city. And you know, I just love the stories. We went to the Canada Czech Republic game. Now Czech Republic obviously didn't have a team many years ago. And it was just, you know, amazing to watch, you know, the fans. And I think there was a bunch of kids named Dominic, a bunch of guys named Philip. The Canadian team had pretty much the same hairstyle. It was impressive. So they went to all the same barber. So it was just cool to watch all the cultures and come together and have this universal language of baseball and everybody kind of reduced to little kids again in the best way I can describe that. Just, you know, everybody coming together around this sport. You put a lot of egos, you check it at the door. And I ran into Randy Wolf's brother, Jim Wolf, the umpire, you know, so that was, it was a wonderful time. And, you know, I had a lot of good memories of Little League. As you know, I have a picture I'll send you, I think, of my Little League picture with one of my teammates was Lawrence Frank. And for all you basketball fans out there, he's the head of basketball operations for the LA Clippers. And he didn't strike out that entire season that I played with him. That's his claim to fame. But we stand next to each other in that photo. So we had a, you know, really good time, and I really love these events that Major League Baseball is doing. I think it's really cool that they're doing the Negro League event. I think it's in July of next year, and yep. You know, we know the Field of Dreams and all these programs. So yes, thumbs up. Wonderful time, and took away some good memories, man.
Oh, good. I'm really happy that you got there. Williamsport is on my bucket list. I've somehow never been, even though I live in the same state, but One of these years, man. And I also want to hit with a bat that looks like a number two pencil. I think that'd be cool.
Oh, my gosh. Or a crayon. I mean, those bats are crazy. Fanatic.
For sure. All right. So you should know that because of Doug's crazy travel day, he is not going to be able to join us for the conversation with Jed Hoyer. But Doug will be back later in the show because he is not going to miss trivia. He lives for the trivia segments. All right, it is time to welcome in this week's special visitor to Starkville. It's the president of baseball ops for the Cubs, Jed Hoyer. Jed, welcome back to Starkville.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here because I'm sure you're aware of this. If the postseason started today, which I'm pretty sure it will not, the Cubs would be playing in it, right, as the third wild card. And that's amazing because a little over 2 months ago, your team was 10 games under 500. So I wanted to start by just asking you, what's the roller coaster ride of this season been like?
Yeah, it's been one of the most unusual seasons I've been a part of. I feel like I've done this for a while, and you think you sort of, you know, the patterns of the seasons of the games, but this has been an unusual one in the sense that we got off to a great start. We had a really hard schedule early in the season and, played the Dodgers well and the Padres well and the Rangers and the Mariners and really had a good first 25 games or so. And then just played bad baseball from kind of late April up until, I guess, like the first week of June, at which point we were 10 under. We got swept by the Angels to fall 10 under. And yeah, I'd be lying to say that there's a lot of optimism at that point. I think there's a lot of frustration because we felt like this was a good team. And the one thing I've said to a lot of people, you know, during this whole time is this was the team with the worst record I can ever remember where the players kept feeling like we were good. You talk to players like, oh, we have a good team. And our run differential that whole time was always pretty solid, which isn't a perfect way to look at it, but like all the underlying numbers we have were pretty positive. And then it was interesting. We were playing against a team I won't mention. We're playing against a team that I think is really, really bright. And I was talking to their president prior to the series, and we were really struggling. I think we were like 7 or 8 under at that point. And he's like, yeah, we have you guys like the third best team in the National League right now. And I didn't know whether to laugh or cry, you know, because you feel like, we were at that point, we were kind of going nowhere. But yeah, it's been a roller coaster. I'm just so glad for everyone, for the city, for the fans, for the team, for me, you know, for us. Just so glad that we were able to figure things out before the deadline, because I do think it is a talented group. I think we, you know, we're pretty balanced, you know, offense, you know, pitching, defense, and I felt like a team that should be in the race, and I'm glad we figured it out at the last possible second.
Right. I'm definitely going to ask you about the deadline, but just to recap for people, first 17 games, 11-6. Next 45 games, 15-30. Yeah. So you're 10 games under at that point, 26-36. Since then, 38-23. Only teams in the National League that have a better record than that over the last 61 games are the Braves and Dodgers. So, you know, baseball is amazing. It's just so mysterious. Can you even explain how those last two streaks can happen back to back to the same team? 15 games under over 45 games, but then 15 over for 61 games.
Yeah. It's hard to explain. During that stretch, well, first of all, our schedule was very hard during that stretch, which is no excuse, but it kind of a reality. We had 2 3-city road trips kind of in the same, in like a 5-week period, which are hard. I felt like we were tired. Our bullpen was struggling. I thought our coaching staff did a great job of kind of through that stretch, kind of getting our bullpen lined up in the right way. And then at some point we started to gel in the bullpen. We got put Adbert in the closer role. Merriweather and Fulmer really stepped up. Mark Leiter really stepped up and kind of gave our bullpen the structure that we were lacking. And you know, during that period, we were losing a ton of one run games. I don't remember exactly what our run differential was when we were 10 under, but I think it was in the 20s, you know, plus 20 or so. And then
amazing.
It was bizarre, but we were really poor in one run games and just, yeah, we weren't playing good baseball. And then, you know, it sort of started to turn around, and once it did, the ball really got rolling. But then we went to, so we won a ton of games before London. We went to London, and including the second game in London, we were 1-6. So we kind of fell back after dragging ourselves to 1 under. We kind of fell back to 6 under after that period. And then at that point we started playing well. And really, you know, since then we haven't had a let up since then.
Yeah. Now, as you know, not a lot of teams are 10 games under in June and wind up playing baseball in October. I decided to go take a look at the wild card era before the show. So that's an era when there's more playoff spots available now than there used to be. Even in the wild card era, only one team had ever been 10 under as late in the year as your team and made the playoffs. And that was last year's Mariners. So if your team does this, it would be historic. I mean, you've been part of some incredible history. Does something like this feel, does historic feel like the right word for it?
I don't know about historic, but I will say it would be incredibly meaningful in a lot of different ways. I think it would, if we can do that, I think it would, and even already what we've done, I think to drag ourselves back to not only not selling at the deadline, but obviously drag ourselves back to being, you know, playing super meaningful games and being in the division and wild card hunt on August, you know, 21st. I think it just says a lot about the character of the guys in that room. Cause I think when you play every single day, as you know, there is some real ups and downs that go with that. And when you start falling, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 under 500 and everyone's talking about the trade deadline, it becomes a huge distraction. And I thought the fact that our guys didn't let it be a distraction, they actually used it as a little bit of a rallying cry, to be honest. Like we believe in this team. We're going to play well. We're not going to let this team get broken up. That was really impressive because there's a lot of noise that happens around a baseball team when you start to struggle and you have some really good pending free agents, and their ability to shut that out in a major market, I thought was just super impressive on the character of the coaching staff and the character of the players.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about the deadline a little bit, cause it's certainly going to be a big part of this team's story. So 2 weeks before the deadline, so that would have been July 17th. You're still 7 games under 500. You're 8.5 out in the division, 8.5 out in the wild card. I guess my first question is, how close did you come to selling at that point.
Well, I would have sold if the deadline had been on that day.
How about that?
You know, I was, I've told people this story a little bit, but my oldest son, he's 11. I on the Monday, I think the day you're talking about, the 17th, I think that's right. I flew him to camp in Maine and dropped him off. So that's the Monday night. We watched the game at some restaurant in, you know, Kennebunkport, Maine or whatever. And we're watching the game on my phone at dinner and we were losing. We lost that game to fall to 7-under. And then I dropped him off at camp and I flew back the next day and I was going to get back in time for the game. So I was going straight from the airport to our game that night and we had a super long delay and I'm sitting on the tarmac and we're losing 3-0. And I'm like anger texting the guys in my office. I can't believe we're about to be 8-under. This is, you know, we're playing terribly. And I got to the ballpark that night. We were losing 3-1 and we scored 17 unanswered that night. We ended up winning 17-3.
Oh, that was the Nationals game. That's
and
right.
That was the stud. And then we won the next night, lost, I think on Thursday to the Cardinals, won the next 3 against the Cardinals, 2 against the White Sox, and then the first 3 against the Cardinals. So that was really the start of, I think, 8 of 9 we won after that point. It might've been 9 out of 10, but the point is, when I was sitting there with my son in Maine, the last thing in the world we were thinking about was, you know, buying at the deadline. And we were really struggling at that point. You know, this is July 17th, 18th. And it was funny. I kept emailing him at camp every morning. Like, won again. Won again. And so it was a great feeling to be able to turn around so quickly. But yes, it looked incredibly bleak. When I was sitting on the tarmac that night, we're about to fall to 8-under. It did not look like, you know, buying was anywhere in the anywhere in our mindset, and we just played great. And then, to the guy's credit also, like there was some emotion of the deadline and not selling. And then we didn't. And then we ended up winning. We went 5-2. We played the Reds 4 games and the Braves 3 games that week at home right after the deadline. And we ended up going, you know, 5-2, which was really impressive. So they followed that up with a really great week after not selling.
All right. So you're on the tarmac. Did you have a feeling then how long you thought you could wait to make that buy sell decision? I mean, you had to be getting close.
Yeah.
To
thinking, well, the one thing that worked in our favor was that, as you know, people wait till the last minute to do deadline stuff. I mean, in this era, it's gotten later and later. Early on, I mean, Theo and I made some trades. We traded some Arjun Hamill on 4th of July, which I remember because it made us very popular with our wives. but we did that. I think we traded Soriano around July 1st. The Arrieta and Strope deal was kind of early, but it just seems like those deals have kind of gone away and people have stopped doing that. And so I sort of knew I had, you know, till close to the deadline to make any real decisions. And so, yeah, listen, if someone had come to us with a great offer at that point, yeah, I might've been tempted to take it to ownership, because certainly when you're, you know, we were sitting, I don't remember exactly the number, but 7-8% playoff odds at that point, which I think is like hitting on 20 in blackjack or something. Right. So,
yeah.
At that point, it didn't seem like there was any chance that we were going to drag our way back. And, you know, like I said, to their credit, they did an amazing job. And not only to do that, but then it felt like we had to add to the team, right? Not only did we not sell, but if you're not going to sell, you might as well go on the other side. And I was really glad we could bring in, you know, Candelario, who I think was the best bat that probably changed hands at the deadline.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm always curious about the conversations that are going on. And all right, you've had deadlines where you've been a buyer, you've had deadlines where you've been a seller. But how hard is it to be having those conversations with other front offices? Because obviously you're calling them, they're calling you, and you don't even know which one you are. Do you have conversations in which you say, if we buy ... and if we sell ...
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, I mean, the two sides are very different, right? Cause when you're getting a lot of inbound phone calls on the sell side, you know, people are calling you, and on the buy side, you gotta be more proactive. Like no one calls you and shops the player. Right. So that week, early in the week, we played well at the end of that week. We played great against the Cardinals that weekend. And so Tom and I decided at that point that we wouldn't do anything until after the games on, I think it was Sunday, July 30th. It was, we played the Cardinals and we were like, let's just wait, see where we are. And the biggest part of it is I just didn't want to go up and down with every game. That's no way to live. There's no way to make a decision. So let's wait until the end. So that was our decision at that point. So I told every team that called, I said, hey, you know, we're playing better. We may buy, we may sell depending on how this week goes and how the other teams play around us, but we're not going to do anything, I promise you, until after the games that Sunday night. And so I had a lot of conversations with certain teams. And then as the week got on, I'd say we get to like, certainly after the Talkman catch on Friday night, everyone's like, oh, you're buying, you're not selling. And so I think people stopped taking me seriously as a seller. I didn't even have to tell people I wasn't going to sell. I think people kind of figured it out at that point that, you know, we had a really good stretch. And then at the same time, the Brewers struggled a little bit that week and the Reds struggled a little bit that week. And so that kind of brought us closer. And I think our playoff odds went from, you know, in the single digits to like 35% or so. And that seemed like the right place to go to the buy side.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Yeah, but there's also all that work that goes into it, whether you buy or sell. Yeah. And I can only imagine all of the seller prep that you had to do to look at farm systems, to target teams and players you liked, and versus vice versa, who would we want?
I think that's part of the job. I always think that's part of the job, though, is that, you know, the number of ideas you have to get something across the finish line is so many. You know, there's so many times that someone in the office will email me a really good trade idea. I'm like, that's a great idea. Realizing like there's a 1% chance that the other team thinks it is, that everything lines up, that you get a deal done. And so I always just feel like so many things in our job sort of get left on the cutting room floor that you just, as a staff, you have to accept that reality that, yes, our pro scouting department and those guys did an amazing job preparing us if we did sell. And I think they're all thrilled. Everyone wants to win. So I think that's the good side, right? I think, you know, preparing to sell and then buying, like that's a good problem to have. You know, what you don't want is the other, prepare to buy and then you have to sell. I think, but I do think that, you know, unless you're one of a very, very small handful of teams, you know, Braves, Dodgers, you know, that, they know mid-May, like, okay, we're clearly a buyer. For the most part, most teams are probably having some of those conversations. You look at how condensed the standings are, you know, I think that most front offices are probably having the conversation, or at least we have to prepare a little bit on this side and this side. And it's a great day when you get to the point where you just know, like, hey, we are a straight buyer.
Yeah, and, you know, another one of the really interesting dynamics of every deadline, and you touched on this, is the clubhouse and the impact all of it is having on those players in that clubhouse. And, you know, there are a lot of front offices now who leave their players guessing about what's going to happen. And I knew you didn't handle it that way. What kind of conversations were you having with players in your clubhouse as the deadline approached?
Yeah. Well, I was pretty open with, I had some conversations with Bellinger and Stroman because those guys were sort of on the block and I told them kind of where we were and I wanted to be honest with them. And then Dansby was on the IL for a while. He was on the IL. He got hurt against Milwaukee and I think he missed the first two series after the All-Star break. And he had way too much time on his hands. And so he was Dansby was sort of playing front office guy for a while, but when he wasn't playing. And so I had a lot of long conversations with him that were actually really fascinating. He's so thoughtful. And I think he was kind of curious about our mindset. And, you know, we sort of sold him when he came here on like, this is, you know, we're getting better and better. And like this, you know, we're going to, our farm system is getting better and better. And if you, you know, if you join us now, you know, we think that you're going to be part of something special, but hey, the first year, it may not be the best team you're a part of. You're going to help us build something. And I think he kind of has taken that to heart. It's like, he wants to be part of the building process and wants to be part of the thought process. So I had a lot of really good conversations with him about it as well. But I think it's important to communicate. Like I've probably gotten better and better at that throughout my career, that I don't know if I would have been as good about that when I was in San Diego, but knowing to go talk to all the players and having these conversations. But now I realize that they're reading about it. I think there's a real human uncertainty to it. And I always just say, you know, I've been so fortunate. I think I've been here since 2011 in Chicago, and you have real stability. And I think to myself, I can't imagine just waking up one morning and someone telling me, hey, like you're moving to a different city. Your wife and kids are moving to a different city. And you realize like there's a human impact of that. I don't think I had the same understanding of that kind of thing before I had a wife and kids. Now I think I look at it a little bit differently. Like, oh, wow. If I had to like tell them we're moving tomorrow, that would be really hard. And so it's the job, but it's also realizing that they have difficult lives. They have to deal with it this time. You know, Cody Bellinger moved here. He's got an apartment. His wife had a kid in April. Like, they don't want to leave, you know? And so you have to deal with that reality.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's a really interesting side of the deadline.
Funny side story, but
yeah,
I remember, I didn't give this story a second thought, but later on it came up when I was with the Red Sox. I think we claimed Chris Woodward off waivers and we needed him in the lineup like that day or the next day. And I called him, and I think this was like 07 or 08. I was single. I had no kids and definitely didn't get it. And I called him and I was like, hey, like we got a bunch of injuries. Like, we really need you to play shortstop against the Yankees like tomorrow night. Like, really need you in the lineup. He's like, okay, here's the deal. I'm in wherever he was at the time physically. I'm in a hotel. Like, I've got two kids that are sick. My wife is sick. Like, and he's like going through this whole saga. I was like, okay, so like I said, we need you in the lineup tomorrow. And he said, he looked back. He's like, it was so obvious. You had no idea. I blew right through that stop sign. I was like, that's a great story. Like, we need you in the lineup. And obviously now I think I do that kind of thing differently. And I'm kind of embarrassed by it, but also it kind of makes me realize like how much life changes you.
I know you're not alone. I talk to people in your line of work all the time, how they wrestle with what to tell the player, whether to tell the player anything. They start to tell them, then they think, no, I really shouldn't.
Yeah. So
it's a hard one. You mentioned Dansby. So let me ask you, I don't know how well you knew Dansby Swanson before you signed him. What do you know about him now that you didn't know before that makes him the kind of player you want to build a team around?
Yeah. Well, obviously we did a lot of work on him before. Carter Hawkins, my GM, had the Vanderbilt connection with him. And so that's a pretty tight community. So we did a lot of work on him. And I think I had a great sense of the kind of person he is. I think the kind of player he is, I think, has been really eye-opening to me. Just the consistency day to day is such a steadying force to have him at shortstop. He makes every play, you know, hard, easy, you're out. And I think that resonates with the whole team. I also think that the way he comes to work every day to win and to play, I think really rubs off on everybody. And I've really noticed how everything in his mindset is about winning. I have no idea how he's playing. If you talk to him, it's, you know, how he's hitting, how he's just, it's all about, we're here to win. I think it's not surprising. He's won a College World Series. He's won a World Series in Atlanta. And I think all of those experiences have built him to a place where it's just, it's all about winning. You know, Joe Maddon used to always talk about the six levels of a player's career, and like level six, which is like the ultimate level, was just, it's all about winning. And he would always talk about, like, it takes guys going through all these different steps of, you know, I'm just happy to be here. I want to make money, you know, all these different, like, different places that players go that are like the natural evolution. But like, he's at that place in his career and as a person where he's just all about, I'm here to win. And the more players you can get to that point, the better, because I do think that, you know, I think as a fan, I would imagine every player is all about winning, but you realize that it's hard to get there. A lot of guys are worried about, am I going to be in the big leagues tomorrow? Am I going to make money? I'm in arbitration. Like, there's a lot of factors that take away from that. And when you get players that just wake up in the morning and think about winning and, you know, that's it. It's a great place to be. And Dansby is very clearly in that group.
Yeah. And you mentioned, all right, you're heading toward the deadline and you're having conversations with one of your players about where buying versus selling fits into building a winning mindset. You know, you've signed a lot of players in your time in baseball. I wonder how many of them have talked to you about it that way.
Yeah, not with that same angle, I would say, because he wasn't just focused on the winning now. He was like, because I said to him, I was honest with him. I said, yeah, right now we're 7 under. You know, we have to look at our odds and look at what we're trying to build. And his point was like, yeah, you can't just snap your fingers and decide it's time to win. It's a culture. It's a mindset. And I think that's one of the hardest things when you deal with building, rebuilding, however you want to phrase it, right? People always like, I feel like rebuilding has this negative connotation, but, you know, I feel like the hardest part is that transition to winning, you know? And I do think, you know, like, you know, we've really benefited here in Chicago by selling. You know, we sold for 3 straight years when Theo and I got here in 12 and 13 and 14. And those players we got were sort of the kind of backbone of winning. You know, we got Strope and we got Arrieta and we got Hendricks and we got Rizzo, and those really benefited us winning. And then I think now we've kind of built a very good farm system on the backs of trading those guys away. So there's a fine balance between that culture that Dansby's talking about, but also realizing that a lot of times those deadline decisions that you make, those really hard decisions, those are the backbone of what ends up being a winning program. And those are it's really difficult, you know? And I'll use Baltimore as an example. Last year, they weren't really in the race. They're having a good, fun team, but they weren't really in the race. I mean, right now, a big part of why they are where they are is, you know, Cano is in their bullpen because of a very hard, good decision that Mike made at the deadline. And so I just think that, you know, we have to be aware that a lot of times, you know, you need to make those hard decisions. And obviously, like, had our players played so well, they put us in a situation where it was very clear at that point we were going to buy. But yeah, it would have been really difficult had we won like 3 fewer games. We were 4 under, 3 under. And I might have had to make a really hard decision. That decision would have been born of like, let's build something really special here. This, like, let's keep building up the young talent base. But those are hard decisions because always feeling like your focus on the culture is hard, because it's sometimes like, you know, in 2014, we were getting close to being good. I remember we traded Samardzija and traded Hamill. There was a ton of backlash. Like, when are you guys going to stop doing this? But, you know, Addison Russell ended up being a, you know, starting shortstop for us on 3 teams that went to the LCS. And so I think that it's a fine balance between like that winning culture, but also like acquiring the talent necessary to do it.
Yeah. And hey, Cody Bellinger would have been by far the biggest impact bat traded at the deadline. And, you know, I've always wondered when a team doesn't trade a player like that, if going forward, you always think about the trade you could have made, players you could have gotten for him.
Yeah. Well, listen, I have this theory that at some point in everyone's career, maybe it's when we retire, everyone should be forced to like write down like the 5 deals they could have had. and also their 5 deals that, you know, like kind of 5 worst trades they offered that never got accepted. Because I think that like, it'd be like the greatest coffee table book of all time if people would be honest about what are the ones that got away, what are the ones you offered that you look back like, oh, thank God they didn't say yes. You know, there's so many of those out there. And so sometimes as a, you know, with friends in the business, we'll joke about those, but they never really come out. And it would be so fascinating if they could somehow, cause you always have those thoughts, right? Of like, oh, if they said yes to that, this whole thing would be a lot different.
Yeah. The sports writer equivalent of that would be the leads or the columns we had mostly written, except the game then changed the ninth inning. We actually, at one point, after I got to the Athletic, we ran the lead I wrote on the Rangers winning the World Series in 2011.
Is that right?
Just because we were doing our most memorable games that we were ever at.
Yeah,
I think that's mine. It's only one of them. So I thought, I actually still have this thing that I wrote in my computer. We ran it. And there's a lot of those.
I'm still devastated. My wife's from St. Louis, and I'm still, you know, all her whole family, they're Cardinal fans. I've slowly converted them. But I remember that game. I missed that game. I got it. I was still commuting back and forth from San Diego. I just got into Chicago, and I got in the air like in the third or fourth inning. And this was pre like good, you know, airplane Wi-Fi. I remember I landed back in San Diego and just had like text after text, like greatest game ever. I was like, no, because as a baseball fan, I would have wanted to be watching that. And I landed tall though. So anyway, I remember where I was, which was not watching.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry you missed it. Yeah. The team that won the game trailed five different times in a game that would have ended the World Series. It's just incredible to think about.
And maybe I look, you know, when I look at my own career and think about, like, you know, the fact that we were 10 under this year, and who knows where the next, you know, 5 weeks go, you know, the rest of the regular season. But I mean, I've been part of three teams that won the World Series. You know, the 04 team was down 3-0. The 07 team was down 3-1 to the Indians. And then obviously the 16 team was down 3-1. And I mean, in none of those series did anyone feel like what happened was about to happen, right? I mean, we're down 3-0 to the Yankees. You're not thinking we're about to make this you know, historic comeback. And obviously, you know, being down the other two times against the Indians. I mean, I think, you know, you realize – you know, those comebacks are what, you know, it's why we do this. It's why people like sports, right? Because crazy things like that do happen. If every time a team got up or down, you know, 3-1, or every time a team was, you know, 5-under, 10-under, the season was over, it wouldn't be much fun.
Well, that is the wonder of baseball. It's what makes it so special. It doesn't happen this way in the other sports. And it's obviously what we love about it. And, you know, you were mentioning some of the teams you've been a part of. Obviously, the 2004 Red Sox made a little history. The 2016 Cubs, that team made a little history. I mean, to do what you're trying to do this year would be a different kind of history. But I do feel like seasons like this, they're memorable. They can change the arc of a franchise. And so does this season feel that way to you, like a springboard to something beyond this year?
I hope so. I mean, you know, again, I think it's August 21st. I don't want to speak too early, but I will say that I always say, like, the two most fun summers I've ever had in baseball were 03 and 15. And they
the
were
year
both,
before.
They were both the year before, where 03, we just had this, I think we scored 961 or 962 runs that year. And
oh my God,
I think Bill Miller won the batting title batting eighth, and Veritek hit 25 homers batting ninth. And we just bludgeoned people. And we had a bad bullpen, and Theo and I used to joke, you want to have an exciting team, like, have a historically good offense and a bad bullpen. Every single night you had to, like, I say it was like trying to careen your car into a parking spot with no brakes. Like, we just somehow we were going to win. But that team obviously lost on the Boone walk-off. And then 15, you know, we kind of came out of nowhere that year. I think we were only like 7 over at the All-Star break, ended up winning 97 games. And that was like this massive springboard year into 16. And it ended with a horrible sweep against the Mets. So like those seasons didn't end well. They actually ended awfully, but they were such fun summers because it was unexpected. Both those teams were expected to be kind of in the low 80s of wins and just really took off and played great and were really exciting. And so I do think that, you know, as an organization, I feel really good right now that our farm system's getting ranked really high. I think we have like real core pieces to the big league team. And it feels like we're starting something that I think can be a lot of fun, and hopefully, you know, we can keep building on it. But you're right. Yeah. I think there is that notion of when you're at the end of these runs, it starts to feel different, right? Because you're like, you kind of see the end coming. There's really hard decisions to be made with players that you've been with a long time. There is something, you know, sort of like the morning part of that, of a run is sort of really enjoyable in a way, because you can kind of see the seedlings or the little, you know, the growth that you need to become a really good team. And I think there's something really gratifying in that.
Yeah. It's also a reminder that the journeys, yes, are really fun. They're the best part of following baseball, being part of baseball. So you have 12 seasons in Chicago. And when I think about your journey, okay, so you went from losing 101 games to what happened in 2016, to then the frustrations, the tear down of that group after 2016, and then to where you are now. Has this ride back to contention felt different or similar to that ride leading up to 2016?
I think it's different in the sense of like the seat I'm in, you know. You know, I came from San Diego to Chicago with Theo, and, you know, we didn't intend to tear it all the way down, but the rules and opportunity kind of led us to do that. And so, yes, that was a incredibly fun journey. I mean, looking back, I think it's always easy to gloss over some of the really difficult parts of it. You know, I remember walking my back door many nights after games in 12 and 13. And my wife was like, you know, this is going to happen. Why do you look like you saw a ghost? I'm like, because it's really hard to go to the ballpark from 7 to 10 every night and know how outclassed you are. And also realize how much work you have. I always tell the story of being in St. Louis. And I was sitting there during a day game in 2013. It was like in late April, early May. I'm staring out at the field, and they had been 11, they won the World Series. I think 12, they lost in the LCS. 13, they lost in the World Series. So the team I was watching ended up losing to the Red Sox that year in the World Series. Yeah. I remember watching the game and thinking, like, how on earth are we going to compete with this team anytime soon? I mean, they're just a bunch of, you know, prime-aged great players, you know, Matt Holliday and Yachty, and they had, you know, I think that back then they had Johnny Peralta and then John Jay. And it's just a really good team all across the field. And thinking, like, we're not close to this right now. And then, you know, 2 years later, we beat them in the LCS. And it was a great learning experience for me in the sense of that these things happen quickly when you get a critical mass of talent, right? That it, you know, we got to a place where it wasn't, you know, it didn't happen all at once. It was like, you know, we got Rizzo, and then we put Javi in, and then we had Soler, and then, you know, we signed Zobrist, and we signed Hayward, and we traded for Dexter Fowler. And it was like just one decision after another. And the next thing you know, you look up and like, wow, you know, you add Bryant and Schwarber and some draft picks to that mix, and we have a really good team. So the reason I bring that up is like, I learned so much going through that experience that the picture isn't always as clear as you wish, that you just have to make, you know, make good decisions one after another. And if you do that and make good decisions one after another, you can start to build something. And, you know, I'm quite sure if you look at the different rebuilds that have worked really well, that would be a very similar refrain, I think, from people would be, yeah, like, you know, it wasn't like you just knew this is exactly what it's going to look like, but you made this good trade, you made this good draft pick, you made this good signing. And if you keep doing that over and over, brick by brick, you can get there. And so, you know, we're not right now where we were after 15, you know, I think that, but we're trying to get there. And I think that, like I said, I feel really good about our farm system, our player development staff and our scouting staff have done a great job. And I feel really good about these core pieces on the team. And you know, we just have to keep on making good decisions. But it does, I have taken a lot of lessons from last time, because I think that was my number one lesson, was we didn't know exactly how it was going to look. We didn't know Jake Arrieta was going to morph into a Cy Young winner. You know, when we traded for him, we didn't know that. We didn't know Strope was going to have, like, you know, six straight years throwing the eighth inning for us and being really good. But, you know, made those decisions one after another, and you ended up getting to a place where a lot of things worked out in our favor. And so that, I think that's the mentality. Just make good decisions one after another. And I think if you do that with the right direction in mind, I think you'll get there.
All right. I've just got a couple of last things. You segue into one of them, and that is, how winnable is the National League this year? I mean, the Braves are having a crazy year. The Dodgers are 17-2 this month, but then you've got another group of really good teams. How big is the separation between those two teams and potentially the rest of the National League playoff field, including yourself?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's baseball. I mean, so I think, you know, we play 5-game series and then 7-game series if you're the Braves and the Dodgers, and you look at it and you think to yourself, a 5-game series happens really fast. You know, you stumble in the first game and now you have to win 3 out of 4 to win the series. And so we've all seen a million times how, you know, last year, the Dodgers, boy, they went 111 games.
Yeah.
They played against a team in their first round that they dominated all season and they lost. Right. And so I just think that it's baseball. The best team doesn't always win. That said, I do think that just looking at what those two teams have done, look at their run differentials. Those teams are playing at a different level than the rest of the National League right now, for sure. And that probably won't stop the rest of the regular season. But it doesn't mean that if you play them in a 3 out of 5 or a best of 7, it doesn't mean you can't beat them, because it's baseball. You know, what are the odds in any one game of, you know, the Braves, that, you know, playing against another team? Like, they're, you add that up, yes, they should win a series, but we all know it's baseball. And I mean, I think the Braves are one of the best examples. I've talked to Dansby about this. That I thought their 2021 team was the worst team in the National League going into the playoffs that year.
Yeah.
And they won the World Series. And last year, if I was going to wager last year, I would have definitely bet on them to win the World Series last year. I thought they were the best team in the National League going into the playoffs last year, and they lost. So I just think that it's baseball. But yes, I think those teams are a notch above. And I think all you have to do is kind of look at their run differentials and look at what they, just the way they're beating teams. And you realize that, like, you know, no one else, I think we're third, I think, in run differential in the National League, and probably 100 runs behind those teams. So they are playing at a different level.
Yeah. The stars are going to have to line up for somebody, but that happens. Easily it happens. Yeah. Yeah. All right. One more thing. You go to work every day at Wrigley Field, and this Cubs team has awakened that beast, right? Wrigley has the Go Cubs Go Magic rocking again. And you know, you sit there and you hear that, you feel that, you live that. How would you describe the energy of Wrigley? That feeling that you get on one of those special days when your team is winning and those people are so freaking happy to be there.
Yeah. It's cliche, but I still, like, it's right behind me. And that is the best thing about this job by far. You know, it's a great city, but just, you know, I don't think there's any place like it. And Frank, if there's any other place like it, it's Fenway. And I've been fortunate to work all but 2 years of my career in those two places. And they're just magical places that when you get these, you know, generational fan bases, and when things start to line up in the right seasons, it really does. There's a energy in the place that's incredible. And what was so fun, I'd say maybe 3 weeks ago, you know, we had a couple of games where I was like, whoa, like, this is really loud. and it was such a great reminder, because I mean, it's a wonderful place to go to work every day, no matter what. But, you know, I realized that, you know, 19 was not a season, not a great season for us. We had some meaningful games towards the end, but it wasn't, the fan base didn't gravitate towards that team in the same way. And then we won the division in 2020, but we never, there's no fans. So those playoff games had had no fans in them. And then, you know, 21, 22, you know, we sold off the core at the deadline of 21. And then last year wasn't a good season. So it had been, you know, 4 or 5 years since I really felt that energy you're talking about, which is like the next level type thing. And the first night we heard it, it was like, oh, it's back. It was so great. And it's a competitive advantage. You know, I've watched so many young pitchers, especially, you know, this wilt on the mound at Fenway or wilt on the mound at Wrigley, the old Yankee Stadium. Like when those stadiums get loud, I really believe that that's when it becomes a competitive advantage. And we're there. And it's also just such a magical place to be. You look out and you think, you know, that with the ivy and the, you know, we've had beautiful nights here, and there's not a lot of better sporting venues in the world that I think than Wrigley Field on a summer night. So I'm just fortunate not only to be able to come to work here, but also to use it as a recruiting tool all the time, because, you know, players talk about it, you know, like after these games, like, oh, that crowd was incredible tonight. And I just think to myself, you know, it's like you go to a concert and you think like, you know, guy plays an arena every night, but all of a sudden now he plays a different venue, and the venues that really get them going. And I think that there's a little extra gear that happens here that I think when things get really good. And I think we're here, and I hope we can keep it like that for a bunch of years to come, because like I said, it's a great recruiting tool. It's a great place to come to work, and it's just a fun place for fans to be.
Yeah. Isn't that one of the hidden rewards of your job? You know, when you get into your line of work, you're thinking about winning and you're thinking about team building. I'm going to guess you're not thinking about what it feels like to sit in Wrigley Field on days like that.
Those are the nights it brings you back. Like the other night when Morel hit the homer, you know, everyone's jumping around. And
what a moment.
I feel like they played Go Cubs Go like all night. Like no one left for like 15, 20 minutes after the game. And I think that those are the nights you realize like, yeah, it's like, this is a fan game. And those are the nights that, you know, those are nights you remember. And when you can get that kind of electricity in the ballpark, there's something really special. And I think I've gotten better and better as I've gotten older, even when I've been on the road and, you know, visiting ballparks during the postseason or end of the season, realizing like, yes, I don't like the fact that they're cheering for the wrong thing right now, but realizing like, this is pretty special. Like I remember in 15, being in Pittsburgh for the one game playoff, it was the loudest crowd I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, like, this is just cool to be part of, you know, I always go back to going to Yankee Stadium. I can't think of how many Red Sox Yankees games I watched in that old ballpark and the number of times that it got really, really loud. And just thinking like this is why they have all those monuments, right? It's a hard place to win. And I think being able to be older and more experienced and realize like, that's the cool part of this, even if it's not on your side, it's pretty cool to hear a crowd that loud or feel that kind of intensity.
Yeah. So well said. Hey Jed, listen, I know you got a million things on your plate. Can't thank you enough for your time and your insights. Hope our paths cross at Wrigley Field in October.
Let's hope so. All right, guys. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a
real POS. You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hey, Doug is back, and we're excited about that because it's that time again. It's time for listener trivia, our way of involving you, our favorite listeners, in this show. Doug, I really should have found a way to dredge up some kind of Little League World Series trivia. You think Yes. You would have nailed something like that?
Well, yeah, I saw Todd Frazier.
There you go. He's the answer to every question.
So I just answer him every time. Cody Bellinger, right? So, yeah we this is a definite answer. Yeah,
There's some answers, but we're not doing that. Okay, that would have been fun, but it's not the trivia that we have. The trivia we have this week it involves welcoming back one of our favorite special trivia guest stars. He's been here a lot to torment us with his brilliant trivia questions. It is Zach Farber. Zach, welcome back to Starkville.
Thank you. I think I got a good one for you guys this week.
Oh, you do. Hey, Zach, why don't you remind people where you're from and how many times that you've stumped us before?
I'm from upstate New York. I'm currently in East Jewett, just a little south of Albany. I think I've been on the show probably 5 or 6 times before. I think you guys got me once, but other than that, I think I've stumped you.
Hey, Doug, we actually got one of his questions right.
Ooh, later. So if you're in Starkville 5 times, doesn't that get you something special?
You know what? We need, I think, an all-time leaderboard for most trivia appearances, something like that.
If we
could come up with that leaderboard, then we could start maybe like a Starkville Trivia Hall of Fame, rec statues of all the members. Doug, get on that. That's your department, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, my statue maker is a little behind right now.
Yeah.
But, we're working on it. Yes.
Zach, supply chain issues, but we're on the case.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So Zach, we've stalled long enough. Why don't you hit us with your question?
All right. So the question is, Jose Altuve just recorded his 2000th Major League hit. He's the only player currently active to have multiple 200 hit seasons. He actually did it 4 straight years.
Yeah.
There's only 5 other active players to have a 200 hit season. But I'm asking if you can name the other 3 to do it as an infielder. So 3 active players that have 200 hits as an infielder. The one note I will make, Gene Segura did do it, but not currently on an active roster, so he's not included.
I was going to ask about him if somebody like him would be considered active. Okay, so he's out. One more clarification. How are we? First basemen, they're still considered to be infielders, correct?
Yes, they are.
All right, catchers, no. Right?
Catchers, there aren't any catchers, so.
I'm just checking.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And is it a certain number of games you have to play in the infield, or is it, what's the threshold?
It's whatever position they play the majority of their games at.
Majority. Okay.
That works. So Doug, I had 3 names that popped into my head immediately.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Freddie Freeman, Trey Turner, Bo Bichette. I feel like they've all led the league in hits. We know Bo Bichette has done it 2 years in a row. They don't walk that much, so 200 hits is something they're very capable of. They also post up. They play in 150, 160 games a year. Freddie plays every game, every year. So I personally love those three. But I did write down some other names. There's Miggy, yes, of course, because he's the answer to every trivia question. Luis Arraez, thought about. Jeff McNeil.
Ooh.
Jose Ramirez, he stumped us before, that guy. I thought about DJ LeMahieu, and I had Gene Segura written down, but now we know he's not active. So those are my names. Who do you have on your list?
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to help you with one. Freddie Freeman is incorrect. And I know this because I looked it up, and he got a 199 hits. That's his career high. So we can take him off.
All right. You didn't look it up when you were
I was prepared for this question, right? I looked it up at some Braves game I was doing, and I remember saying, wow, Freddie Freeman never had 200 hits in a season.
All right, so I
think that's right. Okay, so Bichette, I think, had 200. Who was the other one?
Trey Turner, 2021, must have had 200, right?
Yeah, he probably had 200, yeah. I assume. But okay, so I had Xander Bogaerts. Tim Anderson. Now, Whit Merrifield, did he have 200?
I don't think so.
All right. Seager, Simeon. Wait, Robinson Cano is not active, is he?
No, he's not active.
All right, I'm going to take him off. So
Simeon's interesting, but like I mean, I'm trying to think of guys who hit for a really high average. That's kind of Tim Anderson plays a lot. You know, he gets a lot of at bats, but
he was the highest batting average going into the season of over the last 4 years.
Okay,
he had the highest batting average by 10 points.
That's a good guess. That's a good guess.
And he doesn't walk.
Doesn't walk, a ton of plate appearances. That's a good one. That's a really good name. What about Miggy? What do we think about Miggy?
You know, when you said that, I just never even thought of him. That's like a shame. I mean, he must have had 200 hits, like triple crown. I mean, he walks a lot though, right?
Doesn't walk. He gets, and he, I mean, in his heyday, he got a ton of extra or of intentional walks too.
I thought about Yoan Moncada that 1 year. Did he?
No way.
He had a lot of hits. No.
No way.
Okay.
No chance.
Swanson, Dansby Swanson plays every day.
Doesn't hit for high enough average.
Okay.
Jose Ramirez, you know, Jeff McNeil, like those guys.
No. Yeah, McNeil. Gosh, that is a good.
Did
one.
Win the batting title last year somehow? Sneaked in there and won that.
Ooh, man, McNeil. What about Xander though? Xander.
You think Xander had 200 hits, huh?
All right, so we feel all right. Bichette, that's definite.
Bichette, and Trey Turner.
Trey Turner,
and you want to go Tim? You want to go Tim Anderson?
I'll
do whatever you want to do here.
Okay, all right, we're sure about Trey Turner, right? We feel. I mean, like sometimes I just get a lock in, and I'm like, wait a minute. I guess it's too confusing.
I'm not 100% sure of Trey Turner, but 2021 again, he doesn't walk that much. He had a crazy year, like an amazing year.
Yeah.
Remember, we were figuring out Mookie, Freddie, and Trey, whether they had the most hits of any 1-2-3 ever. And they almost finished 1-2-3 in the league in hits. You know, there's something going on there.
That's a good answer, though. Okay, so, Bo Bichette, Trey Turner, and Tim Anderson?
Okay, if that's what you want to do.
It's Xander or Tim. Man, Xander. Tim Anderson. I mean, did he play enough games? You know, some of his batting titles, he was hurt, right? Ah, man, this is going to kill me. This is where we need Operation Multiple Choice, but and we have to get all three of these for sure.
Yeah, this is not a multiple.
I mean, do you have any insight, Tim Anderson or Xander? I'll go with one of those two. Yeah, any?
I would lean Tim Anderson if we're going to go one of those two.
But really, because Bogaerts played every day, he never missed. He doesn't hurt. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Xander, come on, come to me. 200 hits.
Doug.
Tim Anderson.
Come on, just make a guess. Come on, let's go. You got to decide here. Let's go.
I feel like I'm going to pick the wrong one. I got to think. Yeah, of course. All right, let me think. Give me 10 seconds here. Tim Anderson, Sander Bogaerts. Yeah, you can count it out.
Yeah. All right, so I'm sure that we found a way to talk ourselves out of the right answer, as we usually do. Plus, we didn't get a chance to utilize Glanville's devious cheating scheme, which apparently we still are knowing this week as Operation Multiple Choice. So we're just going to have to guess. Zach, is there any chance it's Bo Bichette, Trey Turner, and you said Tim Anderson was your third?
Yeah, Tim Anderson.
Tim right. Anderson.
Fortunately, you fell in love with the shortstops and you went 0 for 3.
We went 0 wow. for 3?
0 for 3.
We went 0 for 3? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That's just brutal. Yeah.
Those were
excellent guesses that we're still 0 for 3. All right, let's hear the answer.
Third base, first base.
All right, Miguel Cabrera was one that you guys were discussing.
Yeah, okay, sure. Guessed
it. The other one you mentioned is Whit Merrifield.
Oh wow!
And then the last name that you guys didn't bring up. Last name you guys didn't bring up was Rafael Devers.
Rafael Devers. So,
wow.
Okay, so
200 hits.
Doug had the left side of the Red Sox infield, but wrong address. I don't know. We should have gotten this.
Wow,
it's
harder good,
than
though,
it looks.
Being that far off. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, can't we blame driving fatigue, since Glanville's driving like 600 miles today? Can we do that?
No, I feel good that we are, you know, well, how close are these guys? Like Anderson, I mean, they must have, 190. How many hits did these guys have?
Yeah, what about our near misses? Whatever. You know, at least once this part of the segment is over, Doug and I get out of the way. And then the segment gets way better, because that's the time when we bring in the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, to play another fabulous play-by-play clip involving this week's answer. So, Tim, what do you got for us this week that we didn't think of?
Well, I knew there was no chance on Devers. It blew me away that Rafael Devers has a 200-hit season, especially because this trivia question, I think, made me realize more than I maybe had how hard it is to get 200 hits in a season, I guess, especially in the modern era as opposed to ages gone by. But wow.
None of the guys that we guessed have ever gotten 200 hits. That feels impossible. Yeah.
Bogaerts was 196. Okay. And I think Turner, you mentioned Turner in 2021.
Yeah.
He was 195.
Okay.
Freeman, you nailed it, Doug. Freeman had 199 in 2022. His first year.
What about Tim Anderson? Yeah, you have him.
Anderson wasn't as close. I think I was looking it up as you guys were going. I think he was like
injuries.
Injuries. I think he was 170s his best season. Okay. So, but I knew Devers shocked me. So his was also kind of cool, because it was the last game of the season, kind of his last at bat back in 2019. So here is Rafael Devers.
There's a shot in the right, and that is down.
Go ahead. Go.
And a second, 200 hits.
Also, Jerry Remy in the background there, which is kind of cool to hear.
Just going
to
say that. So Rafael Devers he would have been, 21, 22 years old? Then that's wild. We should have remembered that.
Impressive. Oh, well. That's good. I feel good. That's very
good. 22 years old. But that was the year he also had 54 doubles.
Yeah.
And 32 homers. Finished 12th in the MVP.
So that's a shutout for us. Zach, that's another fantastic question, man. thanks for joining us in Starkville. I'll let you know if we ever get around to that Starkville Hall of Fame thing, okay?
Yes,
sounds good.
Strange but true.
You know, there are certain weeks we don't even have to deliberate for 12 seconds to decide what to talk about in this Strange but True segment. This is one of those weeks. I can sum it up in one word. Julio. Did Julio Rodriguez get hot or what? He was so hot, Doug. I had to apply sunscreen just to do this segment. I know I did.
Yeah.
But he.
Julio, Mercury. Mercury hot.
Yep, yes. Mercury hot. Julio did something over a four-game stretch for the Mariners last week that no one in modern baseball history has ever done. It was electric, man. And it sounded like this.
He swings away! Julio with an absolute nuke out to left field!
Look at this. He starts with a base hit left field. Stay hot, young man, stay hot. Way back, way gone.
Julio Rodriguez, home run number 21. 3 for 3. I mean, he just keeps rolling. Look at this.
8 for his last 8? When's the last time you saw that?
Hit it hard, backhanded Bregman. Julio smells a hit. Base hit, Julio is fourth of the night. Sammy to third.
Julio, with 17 hits in a four-game stretch, beats the record of Milt Scott of the Brooklyn Robins set back in 1925.
Yeah, Milt Stock had a good run. 98 years.
Sorry, Milt.
Yeah. Julio Rodriguez got 17 hits in four games. 17. I had to check on this. The most hits my friend Doug Glanville ever got over any four games in his 9 big league seasons. Oh, wait, I should have you guess. What do you think that number was, Doug?
Ooh, that's good. I might have got double digits. You know, 10? About 10.
Yeah, you're actually low. It was 11. It happened a few different times. The most recent was, you'll probably remember this, July of 2003. It was just before the Rangers traded you to the Cubs. You went to Tampa Bay, and you got three hits, one hit, four hits. And then the game on either side of it, you got 3 hits. So that's 11 hits in 4 games. Wasn't 17, but you have any memory of that?
Yeah, it was right before the trade deadline.
Right before the trade deadline.
Yeah. No, I was unconscious. That July, I think I hit like 390 or something a month. And, I had gotten hurt, come off of a rehab assignment. And then, I was still kind of sluggish for a bit. And then July, something clicked, and I just started to hit everything. And, when my type of game, my hot is hits, it's not walks. It's just, making good contact. And yeah, I remember destroying Tampa. They had that pitcher. I can't remember his name, but he was a good slider, but he pitched for the Mets for a minute. I remember, hitting him well. And
a guy who pitched for the Mets. What is this? This is Immaculate Grid come to life here?
Well, yes. Yeah. Rays and Mets.
Mets and Rays, and he threw a slider. Well, that narrows it down to about 1,000 guys. That's good.
Yeah. He was pretty nasty, but he was a little wild. So yeah, it was an incredible run. I mean, I hit a few home runs that month, and yeah, I was a little upset about getting traded, knowing that I was going to the Cubs at the time, who was a 500 team. I know it was a shot to make the postseason, but they weren't exactly like 10 games up in first place. And I was a free agent, and I'd finally come back from an injury, and I was thinking, well, if I can just at least get back, I can have a job next year. It didn't seem like a good thing to be on the bench and then come off as a pinch hitter. And it turned out to be right. We made the postseason with the Cubs, and then I had a non-roster invitation to spring training the next year. So,
yeah.
However, I digress. But, I was unconscious in July.
All right,
for sure.
Let's review. Julio is not going to have a non-roster invitation next year. He's not going to get traded. He's in good shape on that front, okay? He got 17 hits in 4 games. So
crazy.
Let me just go through a few of my patented tidbits, okay? So 17 hits by Julio in 4 games. Over the same stretch, the Yankees only got 16 hits in 4 games, all of them. So there was that. So they had a good week. Did you also know 17 hits is more hits than Byron Buxton and Brandon Crawford combined since the All-Star break? I know they both had some injury stuff, but those two guys are 16 for 101.
Oh, and
Julio,
goodness,
at one point, was 17 for 21. Okay, so those things are good strange with two tidbits. Here's the best one. I thought this was ridiculous, okay? He put the ball in play 19 times in the 4 games. He reached base 18 of those times. Okay, so there was 17 hits. And I don't know if you saw the one error on Jeremy Peña. He hit the soft line drive. He was doing the helicopter spin thing, and it spun out of his glove. So,
yeah, there's an error.
Okay, so 19 times put the ball in play, reached base 18 of the 19 times, including 16 times in a row. I couldn't find anything like that. 16 no. times in a row. So Doug, you're a wordsmith.
I mean,
can you find some words that describe what it's like to be that guy, that hot, where your mind begins to think, I can't make an out?
Well, as you know, Jay, I tend to make up adjectives when it's appropriate.
We need and some.
This is Julianic, because there's no other way to describe this. I can't even understand having 16 straight balls I hit and I get on base all 16 times. That doesn't make any sense. Like, I could probably stand on a little league, I could probably play in the Little League World Series and not even come close to getting on base 16 times in a row. It's just crazy. And
yeah,
he was so, well, the thing that I always think about in this, and I know there's a lot of bias about that I'm about to say here, but I know we're fascinated with on-base percentage and there's statistical reasons to be, but there is nothing like someone showing such excellence with the tool of the craft, the bat, than what Julio Rodriguez has done. Like, it's nowhere near as interesting if he was 8 for 17 with 7 walks. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, that's a great stretch, but there's nothing like someone who is showing such bat to ball skill to be able to do something like this. It transcends, on base percentage or run creation and any numbers you want to throw up there about value when someone just has that kind of capability with a bat, and I just think that's what separates what he does or he was able to do with someone who, may have better control of the strike zone, let's say, because in the end, yes, there is a strike zone and it's created. It's a construct created by rules and umpires and arbiters and all that. But when it comes down to it, as a batter, you have your own strike zone. I mean, you really have your own zone. And who's to say just because you're a low ball hitter or you can hit the ball outside like Vladimir, or I was a high ball hitter, that because you're chasing balls in your zone, that's like an error of the ways, right? Because it's not in the quote strike zone. It's in your zone. And when you're in that kind of zone that Julio Rodriguez was in, he was able to expand the zone in ways that were, seemingly impossible. But he also had total command of everything thrown at him. And these weren't all fastballs. They were every pitch under the sun. These are major league pitchers, right? Yes, they know exactly who Julio Rodriguez is, because just look what he did at the home run derby. I mean, this is a feared bat. So it wasn't like they were trying to give him something to hit. And that's what makes it all the more impressive, because at least with me, I can at least concede if there was a 3-2 count on me, they're more likely to at least let him hit his way on before they would let Miguel Cabrera hit his way on, which ends up on, Comerica Park's, parking lot out there. Right. So in his heyday. So, yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, and I think of some of the things when I go back to, we just talk about memories and Hall of Fame inductions and Little League stories and things that we've seen in baseball this week. And when I go back to my career, I don't think about a player that was hot and says, oh, that's really cool. He was 9 for 25 with 11 walks. No, that's not that interesting. It isn't. Because I don't want to say this lightly. It's a skill set to know the zone. But, a guy that doesn't swing the bat, that's not necessarily showing me as much as it is the guy who's making that kind of contact. That's sort of my point. And Julio Rodriguez, and guys like Juan Gonzalez, who came off the injured list and got 5 straight hits, hadn't picked up a bat in 2 weeks. That's impressive. Okay. That's impressive, because that takes a certain talent, where if he got up there and walked 5 times in a row because he's a power hitter, that doesn't really tell me the same what tells me as being a great hitter with great hand-eye coordination. So what Julio Rodriguez did this week is just, it's unbelievable. And it's August. You want to throw some more tidbits at me? It is late August and this guy is, plays every day, and he raised his average like 20 points. That's like impossible. That's impossible. But at some point at this time of the year, your batting average is going to be within 10 points of whatever you are. That's kind of it.
It's not impossible if you get a hit every time up.
Right.
Okay. So, all right. So he was in the zone, and we're going to call it the Julianic zone.
Exactly.
All right. We had like, I know that Jay Cronenworth thinks the Crone zone's a cool place.
Yeah.
It's got nothing on the Julianic zone. Take it from us.
And his name Julio means July. So that's all you need to know about heat.
Yeah. Okay. For sure.
Yeah.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all season long on The Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you would like to read any of the fantastic baseball stories that we write in The Athletic every day, we can tell you how to do that. Just go to theathletic.com/baseball show. And if you're a new subscriber, you can sign up for just $1.99 a month for the next 12 months. But also remember, you too can be part of this podcast. Every show, we pick some fun listener trivia question. Then that lucky listener gets to join us right here and prove once again, there is almost no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong. So, how could you do that? You could email us at starkville@theathletic.com. You can check out my Facebook fan page. I had some really good questions on the Facebook page. Or you can do what Zach Farber did today. And you can X at us on the site formerly known as Twitter. So, Doug, if someone wants to X a question at you these days, is that possible?
Well, it sounds like you have to file court papers when you say that, but I'm still on the at symbol here, but you can X me, I guess you call it, at my name, DougGlanville, very boring, but I think it will still get there no matter if you put an X or an at in front of it, so hit me on Twitter or the place formerly known as Twitter.
Yeah, don't put an X in front of it. That's not going to work, but if you want to get to me, I am at Jason St. That's JaySonST. Remember to hashtag those questions. Hashtag StarkvilleQS. So, Doug, thanks for playing and for not driving. Thanks to Jed Hoyer for visiting us. Thanks to Zach Farber for the great trivia question. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And Doug and I will see you next week. Starkville.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.